once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning.
Something to that effect.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and then welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, where we will talk about such exciting subjects as the Federal
Interest
Reserve,
rates.
Interest rates. But wait, there's more. We'll talk about unemployment, too. These exciting subjects and more will be yours if you tune in.
Don't forget cryptocurrencies.
Oh, yes.
Crypto. We have to talk about cryptocurrencies.
I was trying to make it as boring sounding and an exciting voice, but cryptocurrencies, people are still kind of excited about those. In a few years, they'll think they're boring, but right now, it's an exciting subject and people are... So I was trying to get the viewership down with our intro using a really excited voice.
Stable coins.
Yeah. What is our viewership, by the way?
Me and you for sure.
I mean, yeah. So we have our radio program has a viewership of two. Listeners may be different, but our viewers are just the two of us. People are always measuring viewers, and our ratings just are horrible when measured in viewers.
But we have a consistent rating.
Yeah.
There's always somebody looking.
Unless one of us is blinking at that particular moment, then we lose half of our viewers for just a moment. It's horrible. Horrible, I tell you. Yep. The demographic studies on this are going to be brutal. Anyway.
Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, in case you thought it was something else.
And we have some disclosures to start before we start talking about the economy. So number one, you already said it was the Personal Wealth Coach. That's our first disclosure.
Yeah, that's the first one. Yeah.
Number two.
Which has a little circled R after it.
Jeff and Jake McClure are both bald men.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they have beards.
Those is the second disclosure is out of the way. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program and or podcast, depending on which way and how media is being applied. Herewith, therefore, and heretofore, because why not throw a bunch of words together and make them one word?
Cool. You need to be in it. You need to be an attorney
or a German.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, we're not just the name of a radio program podcast. It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm registered with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. That doesn't mean that the SEC likes us, dislikes us. It doesn't mean that they are patting our head in approval. In fact, they don't do that. That's not a thing. Those that would say that the SEC like them, it's a good way to get the SEC to do the opposite of pat their head in approval.
Right.
But those are the regulators of the advisory firm that we also manage. The two people that are on this program are the managing members of that firm as well. But just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that we're allowed to give investment advice on the air. Well, what are we doing here then? Well, investment advice is something we have to give knowing who we're talking to. But we can give you education. We can talk about what's happening in the world and what it means. We can talk about taxes and how that might impact the economy. We can talk about all that good stuff in a very general way. Things that we would say to anyone, because literally that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
You want to get the next disclosure?
Oh, I was so wrapped up in your disclosures. I thought they were just super cool.
Weather. I need to put a coat on.
We don't give investment advice, but we do give educational information. And that educational information has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. We make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
And that we guarantee.
Yeah.
We guarantee that we don't guarantee it.
The other thing is we don't pay for this radio program.
That's correct.
But nor are we paid for the radio program. We're volunteers. And we do advertise on KTEM.
For the radio program.
For the radio program.
And KTEM advertises on KTEM for the radio program in a partnership with us.
Why do we have to disclose all those things? Because we do.
Because we want to. It seems like if there's money changing hands, people should know about it and they should know why. I mean, if somebody's doing a paid commercial program, that's different than offering education.
Let me make this point. And the reason we actually had to do that disclosure. We are a fiduciary independent SEC registered investment advisory firm when we're not on the radio. Well, we are, we're on radio too, but we're just not giving investment advice. And as such, we are required to do some stuff that a lot of other folks aren't. And we're required not to do some stuff that a lot of other folks do. And
we have voluntarily given up some of our free speech.
And we've also voluntarily given up getting money from the people who offer securities and vendors and so on.
Right. So we think it's important that the people that talk to us, around us, through us, and at us, understand the money flow, because it's kind of important to the people that are making decisions on their own assets as to who's getting paid. I think that's important. Unfortunately, the rest of the investment industry, the vast majority of it, doesn't think that you absolutely need to know about this stuff. But we think it's important.
We get paid by our clients.
Yes.
End of. That's it. Nobody else pays us.
And the legal definition of that, by the way, is fee only, which nobody understands. Oh, what's that? Huh? Okay. But that just means that we're not paid by some corporate overlord to bring assets to them. Instead, we are
overlord
paid individually by our clients to manage their investments and to give them advice.
Right.
All right. So I think we've hit all the disclosures. What happened this week in the market?
We've got all our clothes off. That's cool. Yeah. Hey, well, what happened in the market? A lot of stocks traded hands from one person to another.
Whoa. In the mightiest thrift store, we were joking about this at the beginning of the episode before we were on the air, that you can never buy anything new on the stock market.
Well, you can in an IPO.
Well, the IPO doesn't release it to the exchange. They release it to the underwriter's clients, and then they release it to the exchange.
Right.
So but it's
if you were a big enough guy, you could. If you were a big enough buyer and you had lots of connections and coughed up a lot of money to do it, you could buy shares that were brand new that no one else had ever owned.
Yeah. If you go to a thrift store and you give them enough money, they will go directly to Gucci and buy you a bag and bring it to the thrift store. but it's still a thrift store.
Anyway, well, we follow the S&P 500 stock index, otherwise affectionately known as SPX. And why do I always put XPX in there? Because there are several different versions of the way this is reported, but it's the XPX version that we use. And it slid a little bit this week, 5.68% for the week. It's down to 4397.94. It's down about 7.73% from its high, which was on really fascinatingly, was on the last day of 2021. That's when it hit its last record high. That's a bigger drop than we've seen since,
March of 2020.
October. No, the NASDAQ is down.
Oh, NASDAQ. So the S&P is down the most in a month since it has since March. But October. NASDAQ's down the most October.
No, the NASDAQ is down the most since 2020. The SEC is down the most since October.
S&P.
S&P.
Man, S&P, we are so confused right now. Yeah, I'm so the S&P has had a drop, but it's about the same as what we saw in October. The NASDAQ is down to where almost as much as it was down in March of 2020.
And if there's anyone who's listening because the market went down saying, oh, do we need to be afraid? If you recall, the Delta variant was surging in October.
Yeah.
And the Federal Reserve was discussing raising interest rates and tapering. And the market went down, and it just did it again. Now,
it's like history repeating or rhyming or something.
Yeah. It's down 7.73% from its high. Now, technically, well, I don't know if it's technical. There's kind of a consensus out there. When the market drops 10% from a recent high, from any high, from the last time it broke records on the upside, that's called a correction. So we're only 2.27% away from technically having a correction.
Yes.
Which is cool, which we need. And I know that a lot of people don't like it when the market drops 10%. A lot of people get scared when the market drops 10%.
But we got to
need a correction.
Yeah, we got to get rid of some of the deadwood. there's some stuff that doesn't need to be up that's been up.
One of the things that's gone on in the market, if you take the market as a whole in this year, well, actually since November, is that Bitcoin is down about 40%. The SPACs, the special acquisition companies, special purpose acquisition companies, by the way, those are the ones where you bought the shares in the company and you had no idea what the company was going to do, but they'll tell you about it later.
In the UK, they call those blank check companies. We sometimes call them that here, but usually we just call them SPACs. The difference here is the way they spell check in Britain is different than here. So just blank check is different for but SPACs basically are, you give us money, we're not going to tell you what we're going to do with it, but we're going to do something. And those were really exciting for a little while.
On average, they're down about 50%. And for those of you who've paid any attention, the meme stocks are down a bunch, specifically
GameStop. That's down.
GameStop is down about 68% from its high. So the craziness is basically boiling out of the market. And the same thing is happening, by the way, with a lot of the high-tech, very high price-to-earnings ratio firms.
And I've got to throw this in here. Anytime we say that the craziness is boiling out of the market, that's a temporary thing. Craziness will return. It may be craziness on the up end, or it may be craziness on the low end. But occasionally, we get back to average, and that tends to happen right in the middle of a swing up or down. Then we overcorrect. So go ahead.
So anyway, the meme stocks, which if you're not familiar with the term meme stock, a meme stock is something like, GameStop is probably the most popular one.
I have to ask this. I just have to. Do you know what a meme is?
It's a symbol that means something.
Okay, it was a trick question. I'm just showing your age. I'm sorry. My age is going. They're using vocabulary I don't recognize either. But a meme, it's kind of short for like memory. A meme is something like Reddit is like the source of all memes, where somebody puts a picture together, and when it gets really popular and goes around the internet, that is called a meme. If it's not popular and it doesn't go around the internet, it is not called a meme.
Well, was there a picture of GameStop that went around the internet that caused the stock to go crazy?
No, but it started at Reddit with the same kind of enthusiasm as the GIF or GIF, depending on how the debate goes for you, animated pictures and so on. The NFTs, most of the reason why those digital assets of pictures and so on have value is because Redditors said they are amazing. Reddit's had a lot of influence on the market over the last several years.
Mm-hmm. It has.
That's what a meme is. A meme just means when it becomes part of the vernacular, when it becomes something new and a completely different way of looking at the same old thing. So they labeled them meme stocks.
There's a little bit of contrast going on in the stock market that I think is fascinating because I'm a geek and I study these things. But the CRSP Midcap Value Index is down 4.18% year to date. Okay, that's cool. We just told you the S&P 500 is down 7.73. Normally, smaller stocks and mid cap is smaller than the S&P 500, which are generally considered large cap. Smaller stocks are more volatile historically, and value stocks hold their value better historically. Well, what we're seeing is that playing out to be the truth in this particular case. The value index is down 4.18% year to date versus 7.73 for the S&P 500. Why does that tell me? What does that tell? Why is that important? Some of the largest companies in the S&P 500 stock index, and for that matter in the Dow, are high-tech companies. Microsoft is still considered a high-tech company, Apple, Tesla, and so on. And many of them have unusually high price-earnings ratios, which means they have been bid up to the point where unless the company makes a tremendous amount of growth and has a tremendous amount of extra revenue and profits into the future, the prices become somewhat absurd.
Yeah, here's an example of that would be Netflix.
Right. And so what's happening in this correction primarily, now it's hitting other places too, but primarily in this correction, what's going on is some of those very, very highly priced stocks that it just doesn't make any sense to have the price that high, dropped a bunch. Many of them are down 20 to 40%. And the rest of the stock market, by the way, the reason the stock market didn't drop 20 to 40% is because much of the rest of the stock market isn't dropping that much. It's dropping a little. And it's dropping a little primarily because people are panicking and selling S&P 500 index funds and things like that. This is not the way, in my experience, and admittedly, I've only been observing the stock market for about half a century, working at it professionally for about 40 years. This is not the way bear markets begin.
Nope.
And so this doesn't look at all like a bear market. It looks like a healthy correction, which I think we needed desperately.
There is a really, really boring statement that comes from economics that is worth mentioning here, and then we'll explain what it means. In a panic, all correlations go to one. What does that mean? In a panic, everything drops. Are we seeing everything drop right now?
No.
So when we look back at what happened in March of 2020 in the stock market, that was a true panic. That was everybody's get out. The world is about to end, because actually a lot of people thought it really was. If you look back at what happened at the end of the boom before the Great Recession, we saw a panic drop. Even the crash, the dot-com crash, brought down all kinds of other non-dot-coms because it was an overall panic. We're not seeing that. This is a slow motion drop. It's like people are realizing, whoa, I need to get out of here. It's getting really uncomfortable. There's other parts of the market that are fast motion drops. Netflix, GameStop, Bitcoins, basically most of the cryptocurrencies are just cratering right now because, and most of those tech stocks. And it kind of comes back to those tech stocks have been funding a lot of growth with cheap debt.
So let's look at why the market declined this week. And there's several whys, and I think it's important. Before we do that, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, the yield on it actually dropped for the week, dropped 1.62% to 1.763%. That's still higher than it's been since the pandemic started. But it was at 1.9% on Wednesday, which means interest rates are coming down in the 10-year in the Treasury market. That's interesting, because if the fear is inflation, and that's one of the fears out there, one of the fears that's got everybody a bit panicked, is that we're going to have runaway inflation and the Federal Reserve is going to crank the interest rates up and the economy is going to crater. The people in the bond market don't seem to agree with that, because the two-year Treasury note should be, if we're really going to have some serious inflation over the next 2 years, the two-year Treasury note should be rising. The interest rate should be rising dramatically, because would you loan money to the government at 1% if you thought we were going to have 6% inflation for the next 2 years? No, you wouldn't. It doesn't make any sense to do that. So since the two-year Treasury note is hovering around 1%, that indicates that the people who have a lot of skin in the game, money, think 2 years from now, inflation will not be a problem. And so that's one of the reasons we follow the Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury note, we follow. And the curve, this is important. The Treasury curve is an important predictor of when we're going to have a recession or if we're not going to have a recession. If the Treasury yield curve goes inverted, that means short-term interest rates become higher than long-term interest rates, a recession is coming. It's almost inevitable that means things are going to get rough economically. If the traders in the people who are buying and selling treasuries in the open market in the United States thought we were going to have a serious economic problem down the road, they would crank up the short-term treasury, like for instance, the two-year, to something way above 2%. Well, considering that the 10-year is not yielding 2% and the 30-year is just a little over 2%, that would give us an inverted yield curve, and that would mean that rough times are almost certainly ahead. But none of that is true. So again, the underlying indicators in the economy are telling us things are pretty cool. Oil, which we normally report on, West Texas Intermediate crude oil didn't do much of anything for the week. Went up a little bit in the middle of the week, and then it came back down, because there was a report about U.S. storage facilities and the amount of oil that was in there. And it was kind of surprised because we have a lot of extra oil in the U.S. storage facilities. It's at $84.76 per barrel, which is higher than it has been. But there's a lot of really good reasons it's higher than it has been. And it is basically the futures market in oil is saying any economic slowdown that we're seeing right now, and it's not, we're not really seeing a slowdown. Any reduction in growth that we're seeing right now is temporary because the oil markets are forecasting a significant demand increase in oil later in the year. And that's the markets.
Cool. All right. Well, we've got questions waiting for us from Inquisitor John.
Oh, we didn't give out our email addresses.
That's true. We must, if you wish to join our conversation, we're not taking direct calls because of pandemic situations and remote studio access and all that good stuff. But if you want to ask us a question through email, we really do appreciate those. The email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. All right. So we've got two questions here. Do you mind if I kind of address the first one? And if do you want to talk about, or, I mean, I, the oil thing, maybe we can share both. They're both exciting questions.
Well, you, the second question is you're one of your favorite, well,
one of my favorites.
I guess, I mean, the first one, both of the second one is really the,
yeah,
he's both, yeah, like, they're both in your favorite.
He paved the road for me on this one. These are areas that I really love. I know that just confirmed my nerd status to everyone that these are areas that I love, as if that was necessary for being on a show like this one. Okay. So his first question is a rule change looking for a problem. That's the subject line. Do you guys think that these four areas need additional SEC rules or is this government overreach? And we're talking about the SEC chairman, the new chairman, Gary Gensler, who, by the way, is, you know, I talked last week about the Federal Reserve and how I'm impressed that presidents still are putting in nonpartisan people there. The SEC is a little bit more partisan when Democrats or Republicans switch office. But as an aspect of different parts of the government, it's one of the least partisan. It's one of the least polarized. They tend to make decisions that are designed to protect the public. Do they do overreach? Absolutely. Is it possible that they have overregulated the investment world? Probably. The question here is on several areas that the new chairman of the SEC, Mr. Gensler, has said he wants to focus on. The first one is private equity. What does that mean? What is private equity? Well, that includes hedge funds. It includes privately managed portfolios. It includes pooled vehicles that are sort of like mutual funds, sort of like ETFs, but not. This is an area that I think this is not a government oversight by any stretch to look into this area. This will help you. In 1933, an act was passed by Congress and signed by the president called the Securities Act, amazingly, of 1933. We talk about this one because that act and the Securities Exchange Act of the following year, 1934, are fundamental to how the stock market works, to how we trade investments, to how it's regulated. One of the aspects of the 1933 Act is a section of it that is ultra boring called Regulation D. Regulation D says what is a sophisticated investor or an accredited investor. And things have been tweaked on it. They've been tweaked on it since 1933 quite a few times, but the last time we changed the numbers was about 30 years ago. What numbers am I talking about? In order to be considered an accredited investor or a sophisticated investor, you need to have $1 million. That's not defined as being liquid. It just means that you need to have a net worth of $1 million. It's a lot easier to be a millionaire today than it was 30 years ago. Inflation has occurred. So there's a lot of people that shouldn't be considered sophisticated when it comes to investments. What is that supposed to mean? Why is it Regulation D saying sophisticated or accredited investors? Why is that important? Because we're talking about private equity, private wealth management, where things are a lot more complicated. They're a bit more sexy. They're sexier too. People say, I'm in hedge funds. The internal fee structure on private equity and on hedge funds is complicated, majorly so. It's very easy to think you're getting charged one thing and be charged something totally different. And the SEC says, hey, we've got to fix that somehow. That's what he's saying. Is that overreach? I don't know. It's probably their job. They need to tweak this rule because that's in their purview. Is it a new regulation? No, they should probably just update the number to inflation. That is their job. They're supposed to do this part. Yes.
Well, one of the things that they're working on that Chairman Gensler wants to work on, and which I think needs to be worked on, is the old pump and dump regulations that used to be, they were focused on people in the boiler rooms with people with telephones. And as a result, folks on Reddit, which you were talking about earlier, who own a stock and get on Reddit and say lots of good things about a stock with the clear intent of running the price of the stock up so they can sell it, mostly got a waiver, not intentionally, but mostly because they were posting on a public bulletin board, they weren't calling people individually. So the regulation, it'd be really hard to nail them down under the regulation and the laws that they exist today. So I think that a lot of things like that need to be updated, because there were a lot of people who lost a lot of money.
And these same meme stocks that we were talking about.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things going on in the stock market that look a lot like what was going on in the 1920s, the pump and dump of the 1920s, where the telephone was new and people were getting telephone calls, and the person on the other end of the telephone would tell them about this really hot stock and they buy it. And it was focused at that time on brokers selling the stocks. And that's basically the way the regulations focus today. They need to be updated because commissions have pretty much gone away. So the brokers selling the stocks, that's kind of gone away. The brokers can't pump a penny stock up to a high price and then dump it and sell it. You know, they'll get in deep trouble. What about the individual who's not a broker, who's not registered with the SEC, who's not registered with FINRA, who is not in, quote, in the business, but still is in the position where they buy a few hundred shares or 1,000 shares or whatever of a dirt cheap stock, and then they get on Reddit and they talk about how this stock is going to go through the stratosphere. And a lot of people start buying the stock, and more people buy the stock. And then the person who got on there and said good things about it sells it and makes a huge profit, not because it was anything good about the stock,
but because he convinced other people to buy it.
Yeah. He was pumping the stock and then he dumped. The regulations don't cover that. And so
they cover it well.
The burden of proof is really hard. Yeah. For a broker, it's really easy because brokers are regulated separately and they just can't do that, period.
So those are updates that are required. Now, before we go on to the next one, because it sounds like we're just nodding our heads and going along, yes, more regulations required on all these subjects. We started our investment advisory, the fiduciary side of what we're doing as an independent firm in 2007. And if we were to try to do it in exactly the same way today as we did then, it would be absolutely impossible. We didn't have enough assets. We didn't have enough staff to follow and legal staff to look at all of the possible regulatory conflicts, because those regulations didn't exist back then. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, it's long ago if you're a teenager, because it's been your whole life. But in this scheme of the regulatory history of the United States, it's a lot of regulations that have been added quickly. The first two that we covered there, these aren't new. They're updates. And they're updates that are something that we recognized in 1933 were kind of required. Hey, you're not allowed to tell people to buy a stock just because you want to sell it. Hey, You need to have a definition of what accredited means so that when you give them really complicated statements on what they're being charged, they can understand it. Today, and I've had calls on this, hedge funds marketing to people that have no idea what it is that they're being marketed. But they fall under the category of an accredited investor, so they're supposed to be able to swim with the sharks and be okay. So that's an issue.
The income level now for an accredited investor, $200,000 for an individual or $300,000 for a couple.
Yeah, and that's not
a
very
lot
high.
Of people.
That's the vast majority of the middle class. That's not sophisticated or accredited. I mean, that's just the reality of the world that we're living in, is that it's not sophisticated. It is not accredited.
For the record, our internet connection here where I am has just died.
Okay. Well, that's what happened. It's not my fault then. I just can't see your face anymore. Uh-oh. It sounds like you're sending your sounds through us. Can you mute that for me, please?
I've got it muted. No. And I'm okay.
Okay. I think we got it.
Okay.
All right. Think it's good. All of this sophisticated equipment is needing updates from the SEC. That's what we're saying.
Right.
Okay. So what are the other things in this thing? We talked about two areas already. Well, number one, he wants to improve the efficiency and resiliency of the market for U.S. Treasury securities. That's a no-brainer. This is the SEC's job, is to make markets efficient, to try to make the way that trading occurs in markets as easy as possible within the limits that are required by law. So this isn't extra regulation. In fact, this is an ease on the market to make it easier to trade. The next thing that he's talking about is executive compensation, and it has to do with a 2015 proposal. If you'll recall back, that's the Obama administration. And the proposal was called pay versus performance. It sought to help investors judge whether top executives' compensation is in step with companies' financial performance. What does that mean? It means that more of the executive pay would be up to a shareholder vote. It's already there, but you have to make motions for it. You have to do some complicated things. They wanted to say, let's make executive compensation a vote by every shareholder, or something close to that. And that is absolutely overreach. That's my opinion. I know I said the word absolute. Why would I say that? The way corporate structures work is that there's a board of directors that are elected by the shareholders. That board of directors is the one that okays or doesn't okay compensation to an executive. The reason why they're voted into place is so that they can take the time to actually measure what's happening in the company in detail that isn't available to the public. They get to go in and look at the books before they've been audited, before they've been put out. After they've been audited, they get to talk to people in the company and get a lot of information, which means that they're not allowed to go out and buy and sell normally on the open market. They're considered insiders. They're elected to be in a position where they say, we're trying to pay a competitive cost to our executives to get what we're trying to get. And if you make that be a shareholder thing, you fall into the area where CalPERS, which is the California pension system for teachers and for the public employees of California, is a very activist investment firm. They're not really out there in their activism hoping for rises in stocks that they buy. They're buying stocks so that they can change the management style. And if they stepped in and said, no, you guys get all paid the same as your employees, well, then they'd lose all their executives. Because it's really hard to manage thousands of people, and it's really hard, I'll give an example, and it's an example that it's a company that everybody knows, IBM. It's been refining its direction, its focus, Are we doing computers anymore? No, but we're still going to do mainframes. What are we doing? Well, we're going to do consulting with a lot of folks on HR. What does that have to do with business machines? I don't know, but if you look at the dozens of different sectors of IBM, do you know someone easily who's capable of managing that many different aspects of things to keep them online with an overall direction? It's not easy. And if you think of a captain of a ship, they are definitely needing to be paid more than the person that is swabbing the deck. Not that swabbing the deck is a bad thing to be doing, but there's a lot more responsibility and decision-making on that end. So I think that in this area, that proposal was based on studies that were done during the Great Recession about compensation going a different direction for rich people than for poor people. And I can look at articles that are out right now that are talking about things like where wages are rising fastest, and it's rising fastest at the lowest pay area. It's actually pay scales are dropping at the upper level. So just keep that in mind. This may be a regulation for a prior moment in history that isn't relevant anymore. So that kind of covered four different aspects of what they're looking at, what he says are his priorities for the year. Three of them we're in full agreement on, and our disagreement on the fourth one is going to have absolutely no bearing on what they decide to do.
Right.
Go ahead.
I think one of the things that's happened with regulations, particularly for, you talked about the fact that we couldn't because we're regulated by the SEC. If you turn back the clock to 2007, it was relatively, and I want to emphasize the term relatively. It wasn't easy, but it was relatively easy to become an investment advisor. The SEC wanted Congress to pass laws for minimum educational requirements and a series of things to become a registered investment advisor, and Congress didn't and wouldn't and probably won't. So what happened with the SEC is they, I think, decided to really put a lot of details in existing regulations through enforcement and make it interesting, make it difficult for every person in the world to become a registered investment advisor and to put a little weight on it. And I personally think that might be a good idea. Back in 2007, there were a lot of individuals, just one person operations becoming registered investment advisors. And frankly, I don't think a single person can meet a single person could meet all that criteria.
It just depends on what they're doing. I mean, if they're giving advice on investments, there are registered investment advisors that don't give investment advice. They give you budget advice. That right. Single shop person, I think that's perfectly right. All right.
But acting a true investment advisor, person who's managing portfolios for people and so on. And we have a staff. What'd you say? We employ 11 people plus us.
Yeah.
And it takes all of us.
Yeah. And there's not enough sometimes.
Yeah.
All right. We've got to play some commercials. We got another question from him on oil and fracking. And I'm going to go into some fun on that one. It has to do with earthquakes. Our next subject will be earth-shaking, but we're going to play some commercials first. If you would like to join the conversation, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. We'll be right back. And we are back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and over there...
This is Jeff McClure.
All right, what do you got to say?
I want to say one more thing about what the SEC is focusing on right now that I think needs to be focused on. And one of them is something called ESG, which is a criteria that a lot of people are using to buy stocks and or mutual funds. It's called environmental, social, and governance. And the problem is, and this is the issue, there is no universal definition for ESG. So, for instance, I was looking at one of the oil companies, one of the major oil companies recently, looking at their stock, and I noticed that they have a high ESG rating. So their environmental rating is very, very high, and they're pumping oil out of the ground and spilling a certain amount of it and releasing methane into the air, but they have a high environmental ESG rating.
Because they bought some carbon credits or something in Europe.
And
right.
The problem is that there is no regulatory definition. And ESG funds, mutual funds, and ESG stocks that tout themselves as being ESG, very, very good for the environment, very good for social whatever, and very good in governance, have, for the last couple of years, sold better than the ones that don't tout themselves as being high ESG.
Right.
And there's no definition for ESG. So one of the things that Gary Gensler, the chairman of the SEC, is doing, which I think is positive, he's starting with the mutual funds and said, give me your definition of why you say you're an ESG fund. What is the objective criteria you're using? And they're going to go, we like the E, and we like the S,
and we like the G, and they're good letters to have on here.
And sales are a lot better when we say ESG.
Yeah. So that's another, and that's one we've talked about it kind of ad nauseum. I've had folks talk to me about our episodes on the subject saying ESG is not as awesome as I thought it was. Well, it will be once we've defined the definition. If that's something that's defining how you invest, it's important to you, then you need to have a pretty good criteria for what it is. And if it doesn't matter to you at all, it's still important that the people that are selling stuff are telling the truth.
And ESG is one of those things that I say you need to ask and research and not take a salesman's word or salesperson's word for it.
Right.
There are, in fact, I'm not going to name the funds because we don't name specific investments in here, but there are some fund families that have a very, very good reputation for being very, very good. If you want to invest your money someplace that's socially acceptable, that is environmentally positive, et cetera, et cetera. Now, historically, those companies have not done as well in the market, but who knows? But the point is, if you feel that you need to do that, do your research on your own carefully. Don't just take an advertisement's word for it because there is no real definition as to what that means.
All right. So on to the next subject. And this is one that is earth shaking. This is about oil as well, but not ESG. It's about the Permian Basin, which is out in West Texas. It is an area where there's been a lot of fracking. What does oil have in common with 1980s and 90s denim pants? You got it? Acid wash. That's right. I just told a geology economics joke. As bad as an expert can get. Acid wash.
That's really close to a dad joke.
Yes. Fracking works differently than other oil drilling. Other oil drilling, there's a lake of oil down there. You drill down to it with a drill bit, a very long drill bit. You puncture the oil reservoir, and it's under pressure, and so it shoots up, and you can capture that oil. When the pressure starts to go away, you pump things down into that cavity like water or sometimes air to get that pressure to be built back up again and shoot it back up.
And sometimes most of the oil wells you see that go up and down that you see in West Texas, there's a pump at the bottom of the pipe, and it's basically sucking the oil out of the reservoir up to the surface.
Right. So that suction pumping, that up and down movement of the hammer, is just like the old hand pump waters that you see in the farmyards where you're pumping those things. So it's a pump that's using vacuum to pull it out. So there's different approaches to getting it when it's in a reservoir. Well, fracking was this new innovation where you could take slate, basically the same stuff you see on a chalkboard, and you could blast high pressure different forms of acids and other oils to break down the hydrocarbons in the slate to actually dissolve it. And then pump that out at pressure again, like a soup, and then refine the other portions out of it.
It's just technically not slate, it's shale, which is different.
Well, I mean, slate comes from the shale layer. So I'm saying very vague or at least generalized.
I'm oversimplifying. It's called oil shale, which would make very good slate.
The black chalkboards have such a high content of oil in them that if you can find layers of that, that is the target that they really want. Okay, gotcha. That black in the slate is hydrocarbons.
Right.
So shale is a much more shattery version of it, but slate falls in the middle of that. Okay, so what's going on here? His question is, will this make high oil prices here to stay? And he's talking about an article in the Wall Street Journal where it's talking about a kind of oil, a kind of place where... they're called reservoir or reclamation wells. What it is when you get this acid wash that you've been using to blast into the ground to dissolve the shale and to pump that out. Well, what do you do with the acid when you're done with it? And this is, I'm going to kind of separate because what's talking here now is the Texas Railroad Commission. Those are the folks in charge of oil in Texas because oil is a railroad. No, that's not. There is no why.
Because in the state of Texas, we cannot determine the difference between railroad and oil.
Yes. There is no why. They're just in charge of it, kind of like the Energy Department is in charge of our nuclear bombs.
And the Railroad Commission does not regulate railroads in Texas, but it does regulate oil.
Right. So just say this is government.
It's Texas.
You don't have to know why. This is just the way they do it. The Texas Railroad Commission is asking them to shut down and remediate their so-called disposal wells. Okay. So what that means is that acid that was left over that they pumped out of the fracking well, what do they do with it? Well, they've got these other wells that they pumped them into. So now I'm going to give another kind of historical reference and then come back to this. Now that we've set the definition of what is a disposal well, it's just a place that they're putting a lot of acid. Back at the beginning of the fracking boom, Texas did something amazing. And this is one of the things that the rest of the world doesn't really understand. Texas is really, really environmentally protective for oil, for all kinds of things. I mean, we want to protect the environment as we're doing this. This sounds weird to anybody that doesn't live in Texas because Texas has this reputation of like the cowboy state and we're pumping oil and just spraying everywhere. But people don't like to have oil in their drinking water. I don't know why that's about, but we've made laws. Oklahoma, during the beginning of the fracking boom, and Texas, there were both big, big fracking locations. And Texas made a law that said, you got to do something with that acid. Once you've pushed it into the well, you got to take it out and do something with it. You can't just leave it there. It's going to get into the groundwater. Well, this is way before the evidence on earthquakes came out. Oklahoma is now the number one state for earthquakes in the United States, and that includes Alaska.
Yay.
Just think about that for a second. Alaska has more earthquakes than California by far. It's a lot bigger. It is a huge state. And if you count all the earthquakes that happen in Alaska, they're nowhere near as many as what are happening in Oklahoma. And if you look at the seismic readings and the epicenter location of the earthquakes that are happening in Oklahoma, this is not rocket surgery. You zoom in on Google Maps and the epicenter is right in the middle of a disposal oil field where they're just storing that acid. It continues to be acid. It continues to eat away at the ground. And if it's near a fault line, it can make that fault line slippy. It doesn't take a lot. If you think about it from a lubrication perspective, if you add a few drops of oil to some hinge that's squeaking, there's an amazingly huge benefit. If you think a whole big door, what is the weight of the door compared to one drop of oil on the hinge? The acid has that same kind of effect. It is making the fault lines lubricated, not like oil would on a hinge, but actually by making space between the cracks, causes earthquakes. Well, Oklahoma is kind of embracing that and just kind of shrugging its shoulders and being Oklahoma. Texas is saying, ha ha, we avoided that. We made rules. Okay, so now back to John's actual question, now that we only got 1 minute to answer it. And that is that this isn't going to make prices stay high forever. What we did in Texas is we lowered the price of fracking oil by reusing it. The reason why it's being stored in all those disposal places is because we slowed down our oil production. Getting that acid out, it costs more to find another place to put it than to frack some more. So this should cause the price of oil to drop. That was a very long-winded answer, but it ended with an absolute no. This should actually cause them to reuse the acid and actually frack more because it costs more to find a place to put it than to just keep using it. There. And we're about out of time for this hour. Long-winded answer, but that's actually good news for the oil prices for those of us that buy it. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we've got another hour coming up, but if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give fiduciary investment advice. There's a local phone number at
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts. We've got radio programs going back lots of years. You can go to your podcast providers for that as well. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, and we'll actually read those things unless they fall into spam. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.